Welcome to Dog Talk and Kitties Too. I'm Tracy Hotchner. I love cats and dogs and the people who care about them. This show originated on Peconic Public Broadcasting 13 years ago, introducing experts and authors to discuss the animals who share our world. To download any previous episodes, go to RadioPetLady.com, where you can also find information about my New York Dog and Cat Film Festivals, which travel the country year-round, benefiting a local animal welfare group at every location. Dog Talk is a production of Pet Media, Inc., which is solely responsible for its content. This show is brought to you with the generous support of Woruva, a family-owned pet food company that makes cans and pouches of foods for cats and dogs in a facility that makes human food, where the only ingredients permitted have to be good enough for people to eat. Woruva recently developed dozens of new flavors and textures of their foods to please even the pickiest eaters. Woruva is also a sponsor of the New York Dog and New York Cat Film Festivals and makes donations of their foods to some of the local shelters who are our beneficiaries. This show is also made possible by Precious Cat Litter, privately owned by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian in Colorado who created dust-free litter and cat-attract litter with herbs, along with specialized litters to make all sorts of kitties comfortable, litter for kittens, senior kits, and long-haired cats. Dr. Elsie has now created Clean Protein, dry and canned food for cats, made without grains, fruits, or vegetables, and inspired by the protein levels and ingredients found in a cat's natural prey. Precious Cat is also the founding sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival. My guests today are Marty Casey, the director of the Donny Co. Pet Clinic in Seattle, vet care for the homeless and low-income families; Tony Eames, the president of the International Association of Assistance Dogs; and Jennifer Wheeler, who takes city dogs hiking, as you might have read about in the New York Times recently. I am with Marty Casey, who runs the Donny Co. Pet Clinic, which is a quite extraordinary institution in Seattle, Washington, 100% volunteer-run, both the people running it and the veterinarians giving their time to the homeless and low-income people in the city of Seattle. Marty, welcome to the show, and my hat is off to you all for continuing this legacy, which is now 32 years old, of tending to the people who are forgotten and discarded in some ways by society, and you stand up for them and their pets. And I think that's an extraordinary way to spend, I imagine, what is a great deal of your time.
Yes, first of all, I'm really glad to be here, Tracy. And yes, it is, but it is an extraordinarily rewarding way to spend our time. It is very hard work. We actually bring the clinic in with us in a truck and unload it and then hold the clinic and a food bank and offer supplies, and then we load it all back up into a panel truck. So we all get a good physical workout on the Saturday days where we run the clinic, and we've learned how to do it fast. And we've also learned that some people are better at loading the truck than others.
That's very funny, but probably not ha-ha funny when you consider that as the person who's now running all of this outreach, there must be days when these volunteers, all of whom have other lives and jobs or no longer jobs but don't need a job, are maybe not showing up as expected. And the amount of work to do the outreach to the community must be a challenge in itself. The homeless people don't have, like, the greatest little laptop at their fingertips, right? I mean, all the things that I think about, like, so this was started in 1985. By Dr. Bud Donny, who and his wife walked through an area of Seattle and realized there were homeless people living there with their pets.
Yeah.
And as they say, the rest is history. But what he did at the time was highly unusual. The homeless population then was probably not even seen as big of a crisis or a problem as now. Or am I wrong about that?
No, I mean, it's always been a problem. But now the problem, as the city has grown, the city is more than doubled in size since then, and the homeless population, I think, is probably about three times the size in the King County area. Pets have become more important in our society and in our culture. And Seattle, we have more pets than children. overall for all of Seattle. So we have that unique distinction, and we could probably discuss all the reasons why that happens, but people have more pets here than children.
Well, the other thing that you the other thing you have in Seattle is extraordinary wealth. I mean, you have two of the major, most powerful, or maybe that's the wrong word, big, fat, rich, interesting companies that are based there. How has that influenced the homeless situation? Does it have any impact on it? Is there more effort being done by those huge companies to support these homeless problems and the work you're doing?
Well, yes, we have. We actually have more than two. Two probably stick to your mind, but I can think of four right off the top.
All right, rattle them off. Rattle them off.
Boeing.
Oh,
Starbucks,
yeah.
Microsoft and Amazon.
Yes, I knew about Microsoft and Amazon, but I forgot about the greats that had preceded them.
Yes, and all of them are great corporate citizens.
Right.
They really participate. Amazon has really been doing some terrific things with the homeless.
Nice.
They've donated a part of their building.
Really?
That they're not using. Yes.
Wow.
For Mary's Place, which is a shelter. And Microsoft has been involved in the community forever. Their offices are located. They have an office in Seattle, and then they're outside in Redmond, out on the east side. But they've been a tremendous community partner for years and years and years to all of the nonprofits in Seattle. And Starbucks and Boeing are also, while we don't think of those as they're perhaps been around a little longer, but they've been very innovative and very important to the community. I think that all of the companies there, since they are growing and are doing well, that does contribute to homelessness because housing prices go up.
Yes.
And it becomes a tougher city. And as New York probably has more, and I don't want to pigeonhole New York by any means, but when cities get larger, it's harder for people to live in them.
Correct.
And those that are unable to as successfully cope in a higher-paced society fall off. And so I think that's why we will be seeing more of this. Our audience will continue to grow, unfortunately.
Yeah, audience being a depressing word. But what do you think about the phrase that there are many people living one paycheck away from homelessness? Even what used to be called middle class or working class people, not people on the margins of society who are already holding on by their fingernails and maybe getting services or not, and maybe had mental illness or not, or abuse situations or not. Do you think that there is some truth to that?
Well, Tracy, yes, I do. And we could probably talk about many things other than the Tony Kobet Clinic in talking about all the causes I think many, many, many middle class and upper class people spend to their means and are really one paycheck away because everything is so expensive. They may have just bought a car, but that still doesn't mean that they can pay the rent.
Right, right.
If they lose that paycheck, they don't have the savings. So that's probably a whole other sociological discussion that we could have.
Well, it is. Alarming. It is, but it is not off topic in my view, because I think what you're doing with the Donico Pet Clinic is probably desperately needed in many other places. And if it isn't already desperately needed, it will be. So I do view those very few angelic organizations like yours, or like Downtown Dog Rescue in Los Angeles, and there's extraordinary work being done in Las Vegas, as being important that those of us who are maybe three paychecks away from homelessness, without trying to be, clever, to understand that this is a precipice that many people are on and will fall off of, and their relationship with their pets. We've discussed this in many iterations on the show over the years, because I feel a sense of urgency about it. The relationship of these people with their pets is what maybe keeps them sober, maybe keeps them from wanting to die or actually dying, and connects them to some part of their own humanity, if not to the rest of the world that seems to have forgotten them. So I think that while the work you're doing on an hourly, daily basis is urgent for Seattle, and you have to keep your head down about that, I just hope that there are other people, just even like you, not necessarily veterinarians, although they're necessary to the cause, who will think, well, maybe that is a better thing for me to do than I don't know, be a candy striper at the hospital. Not to say that that isn't valuable too, but what you're doing is so life-altering, and the benefits are needed in so many places where it's still invisible.
Oh, I couldn't agree more that it's absolutely so necessary and so beneficial to society as a whole for people that don't have a lot to have a purpose.
Yes.
And a pet can offer that unconditional love and a purpose. And it does. It might keep them sober. It might keep them from getting into a fight.
Right.
Because they have a pet they have to worry about. And they give and take that unconditional love from the pet. The other thing is that society benefits so much because we try to make sure that we give vaccines
right.
to all of the animals that come see us. So animals are out in the community that have been vaccinated. And not giving other animals or catching other diseases
right.
from other animals.
Or being even a danger to people. So is it okay to ask, what do you do when you're not taking on this huge volunteer job with no paid people around you? Everybody's volunteer. I mean, there must be days when you think, what? This is probably more work than a corporate management job. And what was it that you did or do otherwise that gave you the knowledge or the forbearance to do it?
Well, I started off my career very young. I was one of those people that decided that I couldn't wait to go to work. So I started working at 13.
And oh, my goodness.
As soon as I got out of college, I loved to work.
That's so great.
So I had a great career. I was in consumer products as a sales manager, and then I moved to Seattle and I was in corporate America for 30 years. And I work with some really top-notch
nice.
Companies. I work with Procter & Gamble,
nice.
Coca-Cola,
wow.
and consumer products. And then when I moved to Seattle, I had the good fortune to go work with Microsoft.
I'll be darned.
So Microsoft is a wonderful company to work for. I have nothing but praise for that company after working. I work for big corporations, and Microsoft is just, they really do a lot of good things.
Yes.
And besides, give products that we all
right.
use every
right.
day. So I've worked really hard, and I've also had good fortune. So I feel that now I can give back. And I hate to say give back because I'm not taking anything to give
well
back.
Said. Well said.
But there are people in the community that don't have as much as I do that can benefit from some of my skills. So I consider it an honor. I consider it an honor to have found something that's such a good fit for me
yes.
to do.
Yes.
And I get so excited and enthusiastic about doing.
And that everything
so that is
and everything you do makes
honor.
You feel good. I mean, every challenge is a problem
well,
solved.
Well, not everything.
Well, I mean, all the challenges,
yes.
because you are a woman from corporate America, you know how to solve problems. It's probably if you sort of grind down what everyone does every day, we're problem solving. We're solving problems. And so
right.
you learn
right.
to do that
yes.
at a very high level. But in the end, you were dealing with people and the movement of goods, services, money, these sorts of things, and having enough money to do the other side of it. Maybe you weren't in the financial department of Microsoft, but now you're having to figure out how to have enough money to get that van on the road and keep it functioning and get grants or get pet food put into that van so that you can give it to people. And then I'm sure it's two Saturdays a month, right, that you have the clinic at the Union Gospel facility, where I guess they're also feeding people, I hope, all the time. And I'm sure each time there's new challenges, social services, all kinds of things that are slightly outside your mission, but they all impact on those humans living on the streets with their dogs
yes.
and cats.
So, absolutely.
So how do other
and
women like you, how, I mean, you don't really have time to go around mentoring other fabulous women in other fabulous cities, but how can we inspire other women like yourself who have had such full and rich careers and been successful and have no interest in sitting around playing mahjong? It's what you're doing is so important, but you couldn't have started this clinic from scratch, right? Or could somebody?
Oh, no. I couldn't have. I didn't have the insight. I didn't have the knowledge. And I have to tell you that I am very new to the animal-loving population. I never had a dog my whole life.
I'll be darned.
14 years ago, I got a dog because my husband wanted a dog. I was like, no, let's get a cat. And we ended up getting a puppy, a Portuguese Podengo Pequeno.
Oh, my.
Because I said that's only type of dog I would get, thinking that we would never
find
it.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious.
And we did find it. And
oh, dear, I'm so sorry.
She's been running our life ever since.
Of course.
Oh, I'm not.
No, I'm teasing.
My life. And she's wonderful. She still runs our life.
Nice.
14 years later,
nice.
We look at her and go, and she's only 12 pounds. So she really introduced me to what a wonderful relationship you can have with an animal and how important it is. And so that's, I wouldn't have been capable mentally to do this, and let alone not having the vet experience. Dr. Co really has done an amazing job of keeping this going. He started it 32 years ago with Dr. Doney, and then after Dr. Doney passed, very shortly thereafter, he kept it going. And up until recently, when I think he felt comfortable enough that I would continue this on, he was there every single Saturday.
Wow.
He would miss on occasion to go to a football game at his beloved Washington State University, but he was there every single Saturday offering pet services. He's about 85 years old now.
I'll be darned.
And he still comes around, but I think he feels a little more confident that he can watch the football game and take some time
Sweet.
Off, which is so well
earned. Yes, well earned. So he has other veterinarians who are also volunteering their times on these alternate Saturdays?
Yes, we have a veterinarians from all over the city and Bellevue that come in every other Saturday. You know, we have a schedule
yes,
that we put
of
out. We ask people to sign up. The good news is that we're becoming more popular so that we can ask people that if you are going to cancel and not show up, you give us 48 hours notice. So we can slot in someone else. That type of structure we're able to get to now so that we can offer better service to the clients.
And that's one of the
one of the
challenges is everyone's volunteering. So even though their mm-hmm. heart may be in it, you know, it's not a job. There's not a time clock or a contract. It's out of the goodness of their heart. So it leaves you maybe sometimes not holding the bag, but having to be the responsible one to organize it. But clearly, since you were 13, you love the idea of taking on a challenge and having a difficult job.
I do.
Well, all I can say, Marty, is the work that you're doing is fantastic for those in Seattle. Not a great sign for the rest of the country or for Seattle that there's more clients all the time. But a marvelous way that you're meeting that need, and I do hope that people listening, if in the town or city you live in, you feel there could be need for that, I'm not going to, you know, send you to Marty's door, but you certainly can go to the website link that I'll have with the podcast of the show, see the work that they're doing, and see if you can think through a way to do something similar where you live. Marty, congratulations on the marvelous work you're continuing to do, and hats off to everybody there. Be sure to send lots of woofs and meows because it's really important work and so great that you're all willing and able to step in and do it.
Thank you, Tracy. It was great talking to you.
And to you. This show is supported by Comfort Zone Diffusers, which plug into any outlet and release soothing pheromones into the area for 30 days. Everyday stressors we may not recognize can make good cats act out, leading to issues like scratching, urine marking, and inter-cat conflict. Pheromones can help lower stress in cats and thereby reduce unwanted behavior. Satisfaction is guaranteed or your money back. Comfort Zone is also the grand presenting sponsor of the New York Cat Film Festival as it travels the country and provides free diffusers to all audience members. Less stress, more love, Comfort Zone. This show is also brought to you by Elvet Sciences, which has created CBD oil products for dogs, harnessing the anti-inflammatory and analgesic properties of the hemp plant. But to be certain that CBD really is effective in helping manage arthritis and chronic pain in older dogs, scientists at Elvet Sciences partnered in a double-blinded placebo clinical trial with veterinarians at Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine. Clinical results show that 85% of the dogs who took Elvet CBD oil had significant improvement in their pain and mobility compared to the ones who took the placebo. Learn more about hemp CBD and whether your own older dog can benefit at elvetsciences.com. I am back with Toni Eames, who is quite an extraordinary woman. She's so involved in the whole world of assistance dogs that do many things, including her own dogs, who lead her as a blind person, but her work in the field has been extraordinary on behalf of so many people and their dogs who help them lead a fuller and more complete life. Toni, welcome to the show and congratulations on what is clearly a lifetime of dedication to standing up for the needs and rights of those who work with assistance dogs.
Well, it all started when I got my first guide dog back in 1967 in New York, and ran into so many problems where people told me I couldn't come in with the dog, and then realized that there were many other people who had similar problems, and then was educated about people with other disabilities other than blindness, you know, who had dogs, and they ran into similar problems. So we decided way back to form the International Association of Assistance Dog Partners.
And this is quite a long time ago, before it's become as much of a hot-button topic or a current topic as it is now, when there are emotional assistance dogs, often PTSD, but perhaps other things, autism. But in the days of simply dogs who guided blind people, it was more clear to people why you couldn't navigate without your dog.
It may have been clear to them, but they still weren't
willing
to let you in.
It must be gratifying to you. So often people are pioneers in a field and have to suffer personally in order to make things better for others. You and your husband work side by side, speaking at veterinary schools throughout the United States and around the world to raise awareness of the various needs of assistance dogs. But how gratifying to find that the world has caught up to what you had hoped, or has it not quite made it there yet?
No, it has definitely not quite made it. A friend of mine who lives in the Fresno area went to a concert and had to go through security. It's a big concert hall, and the person, now he has a dog for his epilepsy and for balance, and they said, no dogs allowed.
Wow.
So they're not...
And did he have whatever the appropriate paperwork was to justify?
You don't need paperwork, ever. They can't ask you for paperwork. But luckily there was a sheriff nearby who informed this security guard what had to be done. See, there are only two questions a storekeeper or security guard, whatever, can ask you. And that is, you know, is this a dog trained for your disability? They can't ask what your disability is. Now, of course, in the case of blindness or if you're a wheelchair user, it's rather obvious. But then they can ask you, what tasks has the dog been trained to help mitigate your disability? You don't need paperwork. You don't need any kind of sign on your dog. You don't have to have a vet.
Interesting. Interesting, because that's the opposite of what many of us, including me, who's very interested in this field and has read so many books. You've written a wonderful book with your husband, A Guide to Guide Dog Schools, and Partners in Independence, A Success Story of Dogs and the Disabled. My understanding was that nobody could ask you any question, which annoyed the heck out of me because of the number of abusers on airplanes, as well as other places, but airplanes, I think, is the most egregious. People just waltzing on. Whatever their problem was, it was sure not evident, and the dog was not even trained to be walking on a leash, much less doing a task. So, in fact, those questions are appropriate and legal or allowed?
They're illegal, yes. Now, the problem with the airlines is that they mess their own selves up by saying that people with emotional problems could bring animals. They didn't say dogs. They said animals, and so you had some pretty bizarre things. There was a duck wearing a diaper. There was a turkey. There was, you know, all kinds of animals that people claimed, you know, helped them feel more relaxed. And unfortunately,
I'm sorry to laugh, but you know what?
I know, but
stay home with your duck, people. We're talking about dogs who are like the brightest members of their species at the level of a guide dog for the blind like you.
Well, again, it's unfortunate that we have a lot of crooks in this country, because you can go on a website, you can get a vest, which is illegal, you can get a note from a doctor saying you need this animal, and so people want to falsify it. I was going to a physical therapist, and he had a little Chihuahua dog, and he loved this dog to pieces, and I understand that. I mean, I love my cat to pieces and love to have him with me, but it's not legal. But he took his dog, he got a vest from the website, and he took his dogs to restaurants, or his dog, I should say, and I told him it's illegal. And he said, no, it's not, or they wouldn't be offering it on the website.
Oh, my God.
But that's part of the problem.
Where there's a buck to be made, somebody will always make a buck. And unfortunately, somehow people complied with wearing seatbelts, because there's a part of human nature, I don't think it's particularly necessarily American, that if you tell me I need to do something the right way and follow the rules and be legal, there's a good part of the population that says, yeah, but I'm going to buck the system. I'm going to figure out a way to do an end run around that. I find it offensive to the dogs who are truly trained and the people who depend on them in a concrete way. Not like, gee, I much more enjoy my day if my dog or my duck is with me. That must be some frustration to you, having created the International Association of Assistance Dog Partners, which takes its job and takes the job of these dogs very seriously.
Absolutely, because, you know, my dog didn't come to me until she was 2 years old, because she was raised by a puppy raiser and introduced to all kinds of different atmospheres and places to go. And so they constantly check out these dogs. And the woman who raised my dog, Adora, had one of her goldens career change, as they call it.
Right,
because
although
she did the guiding very well until she saw Squirrel, and then she lost it. I'd much rather stare at the squirrel than guide you.
Yes, and we understand that. So, I think the number is 40% of those dogs that are purposely bred with very careful thought going into who their mom and dad are, and the mom and dads have great lives too, and the puppies are raised from birth in a very specific way and then sent to puppy raisers, and then there's all the training, that only 40% of those dogs can do all the things Adora and your subsequent dogs can do, which is guiding and paying attention and shutting off some dog part of their brain, even, in a way.
Right, and making you the focus of their abilities. And
yes.
So when they come home, the harness comes off and they get to play. Adora, unfortunately, is a very strange golden retriever. She does not run after tennis balls. She says, if you throw it, I'll pick it up once, but if you throw it again, that's your problem. Stop losing it.
I think that's great. It shows that her breeding definitely engage the higher IQ centers of her brain. Those poor, especially Labrador retrievers who seem to have this, I don't know, it seems like OCD about a ball. They'll bring it until their paws are raw, running back and forth with a ball. Surely there's a better use of their talents. You know,
I was crossing a street when I lived in Queens, and the children were playing ball in the road. And apparently this ball came straight at my dog. So without missing a step, she opened her mouth and grabbed the ball.
Oh, my God.
And continued to guide me across the road. And the kid said, can she be on our team, please? She's really good.
Oh, Tony, that's so sweet. That was her way to protect you. She just caught it in midair so it didn't hit you
hit
in the...
Me.
Yeah,
right.
Hit you in some body part. Isn't that something? When you first got in touch, it was because you do, of course, take very seriously the various ways in which dogs are true assistance partners, but you also wanted to clarify the difference between some of the guide dogs for the blind versus seeing eye versus pilot dogs versus the various dogs that do guide people who are visually impaired. You wanted to differentiate that they are not all the same or similar. Well, I think
all the same. They just have different names depending on where they're trained. So, for instance, if you sneezed and you wanted a Kleenex, and I said, sorry, I only have Scott's, or
right.
puffs.
Right.
They're still tissues.
Right.
Because you've used a brand name, and Seeing Eye was the original school, and so people tend to use that rather than the generic term, which is guide dog.
Various schools
have their own name plus
right.
guide dog.
But guide dog, am I right, it only relates to those dogs guiding people who cannot see, not with other issues.
Right. So the word assistant dog is the word that we adopted as the overall term, but then the federal government called them service dogs. But according to our way of thinking, assistance dog is an umbrella term. And then under there you have guide dogs. And then you have hearing dogs, and those are dogs who alert people to sounds they haven't heard. And then you have service dogs, and they're dogs who do all kinds of stuff, like alert to seizures, pull wheelchairs, retrieve items.
Diabetic alert dogs. Yeah. Diabetic mm-hmm. alert dogs would fall
now,
into
that. Now, emotional dogs are not legal. If your dog helps you, that's not PTSD, is a disability.
Right.
And the dog has to be trained. It's not just that you feel more comforted
right.
or you feel more secure. The dog literally has to be trained to do something to mitigate your disability.
And I think that what I learned with the Dog Film Festival, where any number of films have been submitted about these dogs being trained as PTSD dogs, their training is not, let's say, as rigorous as a guide dog for the blind. Doesn't have as many different requirements of them, but they are matched with individual, usually servicemen and women, who have very specific PTSD symptoms, like they will become, I don't know, withdrawn, begin to cry, become sort of frozen in a moment. And the dog is trained generally, but then to that person, to interrupt that psychological moment for the person, right? Wake them from a bad dream.
Well, they can wake you from a bad dream. If you're afraid to go into a darkened house, the dog can go in first and come back and alert you that nobody is there. If you're insecure in a store and you don't like people coming right up to you, the dog can not guard you, but provide a barrier, stand
yes.
in front of you. But they have to be trained to do all these
correct.
Things. It's not just that the dog makes you feel better.
Right, or that you can reach out and pat them in a moment of discomfort. It's that the dog knows to put their head under your hand, in a sense, in the moment of discomfort that the dog has now, in a sense, alerted to.
Right, and it has to be something consistent. You can't...
Right.
My dog tends to do that when I'm drinking a cup of coffee, and she'll come and put her head under my arm. Like, this is not the right moment to be petted.
Right,
know?
Right. And one of mine always does it when my hand's on the mouse and I'm just trying to finish my umpteenth email of the day. And I always think she's being a nice assistance dog by saying, could you get up from the computer for your own sake and, you know,
right.
take a deep breath and stretch. But that's not what we're talking about. Do you find that there need to be more or less regulations, more or less public approval or disapproval of abuses of this moniker of an assistance dog? What would you like to see different? I mean, other than that a friend with epilepsy.
Somebody really, truly punished for faking it. I was in a store in Florida, a department store, and the cashier was commenting on how well-behaved my dog was, and she was very quiet. And I said, no, that's what she's supposed to be.
Right.
She said, you'd be surprised, you know, about some of the dogs who come in the store. And I said, but you don't have to allow that. And she said, the upper management says, don't make a fuss. They don't want negative publicity. They need to make a fuss.
I agree.
They need to single out somebody and say, you know, John Doe is faking it. He's not disabled. He just wants his pet with him.
Yep.
And it's a $1,000 fine, and they need to publicize that as much as they publicize all the phony stuff.
But then, of course, who is the they? Because a policeman isn't going to give that ticket, if you will. So there has to be like a whole other layer of governance that would be empowered to determine that somebody was a faker. Most of us can tell from a mile off. But then what department of what, you know, division of what
Well, the police can give a fine. But the police are sometimes not as informed as you would like them to be either.
Right. Right.
That's the problem. We need increasing education. We don't need a whole lot more rules and regulations. We have to enforce the ones we have and make it well known. There was one woman who called me, and I felt so bad. Her child was a diabetic, and she read online about diabetic alert dogs. So she bought a puppy, a two-month-old puppy, who supposedly came from a long line of dogs who alerted.
Oh, dear.
And they guaranteed her the dog would grow into this. And she was
oh, my God.
Not been a pet person, so she
oh,
didn't know.
Oh, my God.
And that night, the dog was in a crate and started to fuss. And she said, wow, this is really working. The dog is alerting. Well, the dog was a puppy. She most likely had to go out and had
yes.
nothing to do with alerting. And I told her, you know, make a fuss. Go to the paper. You know, it's the paper that newspapers that,
right.
that print all these bizarre stories. It was another bizarre story about a woman in a wheelchair who fell out, and her dog went from house to house, went up the driveways, kind of knocked on the door with her paw. If nobody was home, she went down the driveway, went up to the next house. I mean, this was one heck of an amazing dog, but it doesn't happen. It's the Lassie effect, and we don't,
yes.
you know, service animals are not Lassies. They are trained to do the things they do.
And they have tasks that they're supposed to do. Yeah, I think that it's certainly better to ask permission than beg for forgiveness. And it seems like all the people that are cheating think, I'll get away with it. What are they going to do to me anyway? You know.
But they do get away with it, and that's the problem.
Of
we
course.
Need to make them not get away with it. Make a fuss. Look what you've done. You know.
Yeah,
you're
and I think
the people with dogs.
And the most obvious place is an airplane because the space is so cramped, even for people, much less a full-size dog, to fit their body into that foot space for people and coach. And I've been on two flights where people brought dogs that were in extreme distress. The dogs were so distressed. They weren't there for the person at all. The person it was for, it wasn't even for their personal pleasure. They were reading their iPhone the whole time. It was just convenience and free. It was cheap and easy, and they didn't have to get a crate and put it in the belly of the plane or pay for a pet sitter. And the dogs were so stressed, and the other two people in the aisle were dealing with a dog that was up and down and panting and whining and fidgeting. And it's just amazing that that person got off the plane and blithely walked along. The dog peed right in the airport. It's like, wow, nobody's doing anything.
Exactly. And that's another issue, is that people are not concerned about their dogs. I mean, some dogs
Correct.
Are extremely stressed with that kind of
Yep, definitely
behavior.
They are. Well, Tony, I think we've run out of time, but what you've done with IAADP's work is fantastic. I'll give a link to your books and to the website so that people that want to learn more, that truly have an assistance dog, can find out what their rights are, how to protect them. And for the rest of us, you know, go tell somebody in a position of authority that you're offended by the cheaters and the scofflaws. What else can we do? Thanks so much for being here, Tony. It's wonderful to talk to you. I'll be back after this quick word. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This show is brought to you in part by Iceland Pure Omega-3 Fish Oils for Pets. Scientific studies show that a full daily dose of omega-3s reduces inflammation in all cells of the body, especially the joints. But it's essential to know where fish oil comes from and how it is handled to be sure the oil is fresh and pure so your pet receives the anti-inflammatory benefits. Iceland Pure's odorless human-grade salmon, sardine, and anchovy fish oils come from reliable sources and are bottled in aluminum pump bottles, never in plastic, which affects its purity. Iceland Pure, from fish in the clean rivers and oceans of Iceland and Norway. You can purchase directly from their website for 10% off using the code ICE10. This show is also brought to you by Zymox Oratine Dental Solutions. Dental hygiene is important for dogs and cats, but most people don't make the effort to brush their pet's teeth and gums. Oratine is based on advanced enzyme technology that works to eliminate odor-causing bacteria and dissolve plaque biofilm without brushing. Zymox Oratine oral care products are designed to take the place of brushing and come as a spray, a brushless gel, and a water additive. Their interchangeable products are designed for daily oral care of dogs and cats of all ages. I am here with Jennifer Wheeler. New York City Doggies in Greenwich Village does all the things you would think a New York City doggy facility would, although facility isn't the word, enabler of greatness for dogs. You know, boarding and dog sitting and walking and that sort of thing. But how about hiking off leash in the woods? You might have read an article in the New York Times a couple of months back, and I will put a link to that wonderful article in with the podcast of the show. But Jennifer, you are the inventor of New York City dogs going for hikes for New York City Doggies, and you're the co-owner of the company. So welcome to the show, and congratulations on your forward thinkingness on behalf of the four-leggeds in the city.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it was a great article.
I'm really happy to talk to you about it.
It was a great article and wonderful photos. And funnily enough, three of the dogs that are featured a lot on your website, and maybe you want to give other people's dogs more anonymity. I didn't know all of them were yours. You write a wonderful blog, and you have a most gorgeous dachshund named Ollie, but also an adorable basset and a magnificent German shepherd. Do those three of your dogs get to go on all the hikes or only on special occasions?
So they get to go sometimes. Ollie and Emma are a little elderly, and they can't quite keep up for the 3 hours on the hikes anymore. So we take them on the weekends ourselves with our family.
Nice.
But Azzy, our German Shepherd, still hikes. Every day we get anytime we get a cancellation, he gets to fill the slot. So
he's sitting there in the corner of the living room with his little paws crossed going, please, somebody cancel,
waiting.
Cancel, somebody
cancel. Today.
Please,
yeah,
somebody.
Exactly.
So talk about this hiking. It warmed to my heart because, and it turns out reading carefully on your beautiful website that you are a native Vermonter. I'm a Flatlander,
yeah.
So I live here now, but I'm a transplant,
yeah,
as are so many people. What area did you grow up in or live in?
I grew up in the Stowe area.
Ooh, that's not too beautiful. And I guess you got very used to the idea of hikes and streams and mountain paths because that's a lot of what Vermont is about. So many New York City dogs are not necessarily the right kind of dog for the city, but they're not the right kind of dog for the suburbs either. I think what you have created in these hikes is something that the vast majority of dogs never have the experience to do. And even if they're home, if they're humans, had the time or the energy or the car or the wherewithal, they'd be scared to take their dog off leash. So let's talk about what you liberate in these dogs by taking them on these hikes.
Well, first of all, I think that I haven't met a dog yet who's not the right dog for a hike.
Nice.
I think kind of no matter what the breed or background of the dog, they all find something beautiful in the hikes. So I did grow up in Vermont. We had three dogs. Going for hikes was just part of the sort of everyday life for
dogs.
Yes,
me too. Yes.
And I moved to the city 20 years ago for school and had my own dogs here and started taking them on hikes because it wasn't enough going to the dog park and the walks. It's great. But no matter how much you can exercise them in the city, having them off leash and being able to dig and roll,
yes,
and chase things and swim and the feeling of freedom, they change. Like you can see it in their faces, in their body language. Something shifts and they get to really be dogs and
yes,
take it all in a totally different way. And they're happier. They're happier on hikes, but they're also happier when they're back in the city.
And how did you figure out where you could put them all in your vehicle and take them legally, you know, that they were allowed to all be off the leash and it was accessible to New York City for you to pick them all up? You pick them up in several of the boroughs, right? I mean, your business is based in Greenwich Village, but you go to the Upper West Side, the Lower East Side, you go everywhere to pick up the dogs, correct?
We pick them mostly up from downtown Manhattan. We did for a time pick them up on the Upper East and Upper West Side, but the traffic was really bad. We found the days to be a little bit long, and our clients a little bit too spread out.
Yes.
So we now really just focus on the downtown Manhattan area. And I, you know, for about a year before starting to take NYC doggies, was just taking our own and experimenting a lot, you know, exploring new places. trying it out, seeing what was suitable and what wasn't. So it was a lot of places that weren't great before we found the places that, that were.
And when you go there, from what I read on your blog and even in the New York Times article, you're not encountering hardly any people and barely any dogs. I mean, it seems like your own private wonderland.
Yeah, we stay away from places where we'll encounter other people or dogs to the best that we can because it gives us a little more freedom to let the dogs off leash.
And doesn't and I find other people wherever they are, whether they're in the deep woods of East Hampton, which is a bit of a joke, but I really did live in a white pine forest there in the Northwest woods, or even in Vermont in hundreds of acres that are open, if people are fearful dog owners and either
for sure
attached to the leash or just fearful, it creates a problem because our dogs, let's say, or your hiking dogs are loose and that other person's dog and the person are sort of screamingly terrified of just dogs
sure
being natural off the leash, right?
For sure. Whenever we pass people on the trail, we always leash the dogs. And that's why we only take four at a time. One of the reasons why we only take maximum four. They can be quickly leashed every time we pass by somebody because, and I get it, people are scared. You can't
mm-hmm.
tell them from a distance, my dogs are really friendly, don't
Correct.
Worry, you know. It's I don't blame them. People are scared. We always leash the dogs when we encounter other people or dogs.
That's a really interesting point, an interesting point for any of us that go a bit off road with our dogs, is that even though I used to say, because I had dogs who were sort of bomb-proof with other dogs, and now I have Weimaraners that are very picky about who they want to be nice to and not,
mm-hmm.
you can say my dogs are friendly, but the dog they're encountering may not be. So
Correct.
Your dog's been friendly until it meets a dog who's standing in an erect posture with his hair up and his tail frozen. All of a sudden, it's not about the dogs who are loose anymore. The dog who
right.
isn't loose could be not a great operator. Four seems like a great number. I noticed in the article mm-hmm. there were some other services that hike dogs with a
mm-hmm.
lot of dogs. And
yeah.
I think any of us that have children, little children, you wouldn't take 8 or 9 children anywhere unless you had like 6 minders.
100%.
It's a little bit herding cats. I mean, no matter how great the dogs are, and I'd like you to talk about the dogs sticking together, things happen. And what if one dog gets stuck in some twigs and you have to go extricate it? Now the other dogs are dashing ahead far away.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you come up with that number?
Trial and error. We used to take only 3. Then we started taking 4, but they're mixed sizes, which helps. So basically, that's the rule of thumb for us. Imagine a worst-case scenario where one dog is injured or getting into trouble. Can you leash 3 dogs,
right.
hold them in one hand, and deal with the other dog at the same time? 5, I tried once. And I decided it was too much, that we would never go beyond 4. I don't think it's safe. I don't think it's safe for anybody.
I think that's a really that's good for peace of mind to people willing to try this. There may be people whose dogs have country houses and go places on the weekend, and they know that their dog's great in the wild and can go leaping into a pond. There seems to be a great deal of leaping into the ponds on your hikes, which is pretty fabulous because some of the dogs leaping in the pond, you think, really, that dog is happy to leap in the pond? Good for them. But
yeah.
there is always, even if you aren't a helicopter animal parent, that worry, but what if? Have you had anything disturbing happen? Like I've had my own dogs run into a branch and sort of stab themselves in the chest or once cut their paw on something. But have you had anything happen at all? I mean, my guess is probably not.
Over the course of, how long have we been doing this, 8 or 9 years, we've had a couple of things happen. Nothing really serious. One of our dogs once stuck his face in a wasp nest.
Oh, God.
He was fine. Everybody was fine, but obviously we were worried, so we gathered everybody up. And everywhere where we hike, we know where the closest veterinary clinic is. So we popped
Smart.
Into the clinic. They checked him out. It was fine. We came home. And one dog, it was another dachshund. About the same size as my Ollie, scraped her side on a branch coming out of
right.
the ground.
And that was it. Yeah, I actually ground bees and wasps in old rotting logs is part of nature and pretty disturbing. I once had it happen to my Cocker Spaniel in the woods in East Hampton, and he took off, and they were all kind of still chasing him. They're nasty and aggressive. And then I wound up trying to get them off of him by kind of beating them off, and they all went up my shirt and up my jacket. Yeah, they're nasty critters, but you know it's not exactly one of the risks you take. It's just one of the things that can happen. It's certainly better than a skunk or a porcupine. Have you encountered those? They're nocturnal, I think.
No, we've seen raccoons. We've never had a, you know, physical encounter with a raccoon. We've seen raccoons, but we've never encountered a porcupine.
Those are the worst things that have happened to dogs, which is very few and very mild. What's the hardest thing that you've had to do to deal with people? I imagine that once you got the dogs in the vehicle and you're headed out and they're all excited, it's a great time, then they're all pooped on the way back. But what about the nervous Nelly kind of control freaky kind of owners? What are some of your biggest challenges with them?
Well, I mean, all our dogs have GPS collars, which really puts at ease a lot of owners who are worried about that, and they all have a good command. We have two requirements. The dogs have to be friendly and they have to be able to respond to calm. So we have the GPS collars. That puts the owner's minds at rest. I would say ticks are probably the most common fear of owners, and it's a legitimate fear with the rays of the...
Right.
Lyme disease is becoming more prevalent and more ticks. But we take a lot of precautions and by, you know, 3-4 hikes, everybody gets used to it. We haven't had any.
They realize their dog's going to come back happier and more chilled and more balanced than when they sent them out. So you have people put external tick protection on their dogs?
So they all have, they've either been treated with something that goes on the skin, like a front line, and if they can't, they wear a flea and tick collar.
Right.
During peak season, we use like natural oil-based sprays on the dogs whose parents let us put it on. We spray them with that. We check after the hikes for ticks. We have the parents check after the hikes for ticks. And then we, anytime an owner finds a tick, we have them alert us. And if it seems to be happening in there's certain areas, certain times of year that have more ticks, we stay away from them.
Smart. So you're on preventive tick patrol in that way, too. You sort of have a geographical mental map of it. How many of you, four dogs per hike, but do you have more than one person so you could have eight dogs?
We have two cars and two hikers. And sometimes they go on the same day. We don't like to put more than four dogs in a car either because the energy level gets crazy.
Yes, definitely. Mm-hmm.
It's too much in a small space, even though the cars are quite spacious. So sometimes they will hike at the same location and cross paths, but we don't have them go together for the same reason. Even though you have two handlers and eight dogs, the division doesn't quite work like that because it's a huge group of dogs. They get really excited about one thing. The energy level is again can get a little out of control. So
interesting. They are pack animals. It's definitely true. Yeah. And they pick up each other's energy and feed off it, be it good or bad. So that's good to sort of keep it more contained. Mm-hmm. Are you fully booked throughout the year kind of thing? I mean, how your most loyal and devoted and addicted customers, how often do they send their dog out on a hike in a week?
Most clients send their dogs once a week. We have clients who send their dogs three times a week. And in the past, we've had clients who send their dogs 5 days a week.
Wow.
We just added our second vehicle. So we have some openings now.
Nice.
But yeah, the spots fill up pretty quickly.
I can imagine.
We save the spots for regular hikers who go once every week because it helps us be able to schedule better. And then occasional hikers, like if we have a cancellation or last minute opening, we fill the spots with occasional hikers.
Have you ever had a human wanting to go with?
We have had humans.
I can see that. I mean, either they're just filled with joyful, childish curiosity, or just like, I just got to see this for myself and put my mind at rest.
So, we've had a lot of people ask us. We've sent clients, like we've given them information about where to hike on the weekends, just so they can have the experience themselves with the dog. People who've never really gone for hikes outside the city before, and that's pretty fun.
Yeah, because then the humans are becoming less citified too.
Yeah,
they're getting more of a sense of what
real
nature is like.
And they really get to see what their dog experiences. Which is fun. But we don't usually take people along with us. But
you'd have to charge the same amount for hiking the person as for hiking a dog. They're probably more trouble. I got to sit down. My feet are sore. Oh, I need water. My yoga top is pinching
me. Exactly.
Yeah, the dogs are just so happy to be there. So the off-leash part, it seems to me, is the part that's the biggest revelation for the dogs and for the people, that dogs do great off-leash, that they're their own best selves usually, and they don't run away. Dogs don't want to run away from other dogs and people who are nice to them.
No, they don't. They don't. Particularly when we moved. So we found that even dogs who have been prone to running away from their owners when their owners are stationary in a park don't do it on a hike because they know the pack is moving.
Yep. And they know that it's not all going to be over in a minute and the fun's going to end and the whistle blows and on goes the leash or the harness and it's all over. In the hike, it just, I'm sure to them, feels like it goes on and on and on because the pleasure goes on and on and on. Well, Jennifer, I think it's a fantastic service and idea that you had, and the way you're carrying it out sounds incredibly thoughtful and wise. So I'll have the link to article so people can see for themselves, and a link to your website so they can look at your videos and your photos. It's all pretty delicious.
Thanks so much. It was a delight to talk to you.
And to you too. And if I weren't in Vermont with my dogs going to do this every day, I would absolutely put Maisie and Wanda at the top of your list, and they could be the leaders of the pack. Thanks so much for being here. Thank you all for listening. Hug your kitties, kiss your pooches, and we will talk again next week. Bye for now.